Welcome to Money Markets and Masterminds, a Citywire South Africa podcast that explores finance, investment, and strategic decision-making. If you're a fund selector, an independent financial advisor, or an institutional allocator looking for sharp insights, you are in the right place here with me, editor Ruan Uister. Today's conversation forms part of our regular Long Game series, where we look past the headlines and explore the deeper forces shaping long-term investment thinking. Today, we are discussing one of the presentations investment strategist and GIPS professor Adrian Saville delivered in the GIPS MBA program, which he recently adapted for a wider audience at the High Street Auction event, which hosted economists, strategists, academics, and political analysts. It's titled The Age of Fracture, and it provides a powerful framework for understanding how the old global order is being reshaped. Adrian, thank you for joining us again today.
Great being with you, Ron.
Adrian, your presentation opens with a claim that the last 2 years have brought political change not seen since the fall of the Berlin Wall. Elections, shifting alliances, and leaders like the new Japanese prime ministers all point to a new political rhythm. So my question is, are we entering a new political era, and what signals convince you this shift is structural?
You know, that's certainly my sense, Ruan. First, you know, to make a behavioral point that people vote habitually, that you generally don't see people sort of swinging between parties. They vote the way they voted at the last election, they'll vote similar way at the next election. So when you see, you know, shifting political sands, one temptation is to say, people have changed their minds. Yes, perhaps, you know, that's at the margin. But for the most part, what outcomes reflect are a changing political body, that you've got a different composition. Now, I'll make that point because over the last 18 months, 24 months, more people have been to the polls than any period in history, as a percentage of world population, and obviously as an absolute number. And there are two important points behind this throwaway stat. The first is that overwhelmingly democracy held. In other words, the institutions are strong. That's a big point. The however is, in the majority of elections, there was a change in political power. The grandstand, the headline, of course, goes to November, where Republicans replaced Democrats. But we can find umpteen other examples: Botswana, South Africa, the UK, France, and then most recently Japan. Although they have a continuity in political power, they have elected a woman as head of state. So there's this broad sweeping change in political footprint, and it looks like 1989 in terms of the resonance. And 1989, this is where the Berlin Wall comes down after Ronald Reagan urges Gorbachev, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. And what ensued was 20 years of globalization, entrenchment of the institution of democracy, international trade, capital movements, the movement of people, all characterized the 1990s into the noughties. There is a very big however now, and the however is, if that is what has characterized the world because of the political sweeping change of the 1980s into the 1990s, it has to beg the question: are we on the cusp of a similar wave of change? And my strong belief, more than suspicion, my strong belief is absolutely.
Adrian, your slides also show that global economic gravity has been drifting toward the East and the South for decades. Mm. World Bank and IMF data and the growing scale of BRICS and BRICS Plus reinforced this shift. So how should investors interpret the shift in economic gravity, and what does it imply for opportunity or diversification?
You know, Ron, let's use history as a guide again. if you look at, you know, what emerges as a result of the fall of the wall, the disaggregation of the Soviet Union, and so on, you see the emergence of brand new forces. And China goes from being the 100th biggest economy in the world in the 1970s, 80s, to becoming, adjusted for purchasing power parity, the largest economy in the world by 2012. Now, you know, that's just one example, and an anecdote, you know, certainly isn't data, but it talks to the point that you're underscoring, that there is this emergence over the last 30, 40 years of the global South. And the global South, you know, you could give these other labels, you could call these emerging markets, frontier markets, developing economies. We, you know, are quickly able to identify this cluster. You know, perhaps BRICS Plus is the convenient recent collective for the countries that make up the global South. And the economic weight of this global South has been steadily increasing decade after decade, because they have structural forces that are helping them grow quicker than the average. And whilst they were, for all of recorded history, or you know, recent recorded economic history, smaller than the global North, recently the global South overtook the global North in terms of contribution to world GDP. And the fact that they have overtaken and are now crocodile jawing tells us that this isn't a hiccup or a blip, that this is a force that we can project with a degree of confidence that in 10 years' time, even bigger, and in 10 years after that, even bigger. And so that ushers in an entirely new epoch if we put together my observations around the political shifts and the economic shifts. These are two very powerful forces that have new drivers in charge.
You then go on to examine how power is used. Your slides reference almost unbalanced victories, the new bank example, STEM dominance in China and India, and the cultural influence of East Asian brands and K-pop. So how do hard power and soft power combine to shape global outcomes? And why does soft power matter for investors?
I mean, it's such a fascinating subject that, you know, most often a conversation, you know, in talking about, you know, what does the world look like, centers around economics and politics, as we've just done. You know, we've focused on the obvious things. But if you think of, you know, the way in which behaviors are shaped, beliefs are influenced, alliances are forged, soft power oftentimes wins the day. So military spending, you know, is a good place to go and say, well, you know, look who's got the guns and the boats. But, you know, what the way soft power plays out in this cocktail is, soft power references culture, the music we listen to, that you would sympathize with a certain country or set of beliefs. And that then shapes your alliances, whether it's your political alliances, your trade agreements, your economic partnerships, your exchange of capital in making investments across borders, the ease with which people are allowed in and out of your country, you know, in trying to move across borders, whether it's capital, goods, people, soft power will have a disproportionate influence on the ease with which we partner and the people we choose to partner. And so the soft power that I'm referencing is systems, software, technology, engineering capability, and the music we listen to and the media and movies, you know, that we watch and read.
Adrian, your literature scan identifies six forces driving global fracture. There's geography, demographics, war, climate, artificial intelligence, and politics. You highlight three: geography, which is the competition for critical minerals and the rise in resource nationalism; climate, the high vulnerability in poorly prepared countries; and artificial intelligence. The world is approaching a Q-day when quantum computing becomes commercially accessible. So my question is, why are these three forces so central to the coming decade, and what are markets overlooking?
Ron, we shouldn't dismiss the other, you know, the other three that you've listed in that lineup of six. But you know, my sense, and this is certainly sort of opinion, rather than being able to draw on hard facts and say, you see, it is geography that matters. But you know, my strong sense is that these belong most in the conversation because not only are they highly influential, they are overwhelmingly ignored. And that means there is a large information gap that presents some combination of risk and opportunity, where you have, you know, asymmetric information or things that matter but are overlooked, ignored, or misunderstood. And you know, just to dwell on each of those for a moment, geography, what has really shaped the trade conversations that have been front and center over the course of this year, geography has mattered far more than I think people anticipated at the beginning of the year. And what I mean by that is, you know, when push came to shove, it was access to metals, minerals, rare earths, etc. That became the draw card. That became the trump card, you know, pun intended. And so, you know, this really underlines the importance of knowing not just who your neighbors are, but what they sit on top of in terms of the resources that they are home to. And, you know, then if we scan the world and ask, you know, who's got what, we know that places like the Soviet bloc, Russia in particular, is disproportionately rich. Latin America is disproportionately rich. Africa is disproportionately rich. South Africa is a standout example. And so this gives you soft power in a tough world. The second that you reference is vulnerability to climate. And change is underway. It's hard to refute the data. You know, I'm not in search of, you know, now going to try and find who's to blame and who do we hold accountable. That's a conversation for a different day. For this moment, we have change underway. And if change is underway, then it begs two very obvious questions. Who is most vulnerable? And unsurprisingly, the places that I've just mentioned being resource-rich are also the most vulnerable, and perversely, they are also the least prepared. And so this puts in another element of complexity into the cocktail is that, you know, on the one hand, they are now blessed with the soft power of resource abundance, rare elements, rare earths, etc., but in the next breath, they are cursed by climate. And so what do you do with that? And then the third that we cannot possibly dismiss is artificial intelligence, which becomes the new workforce. The productivity gains, the potential that is available in artificial intelligence is spectacular. The however that I want to put into this observation is there is an element here that is almost entirely overlooked, and it's the approach of Q-Day, and Q-Day is the day on which quantum computing becomes commercially available. On that day, I would venture that many bets are off in terms of software systems, security, bank codes can be broken. Your encrypted WhatsApp is suddenly public domain. But you know, in the same fashion, there are incredible things that can be generated by this. Think of, you know, the DNA sequencing or the medical advances that could be made through quantum computing. people suggest that this is decades away. I think that we are much closer to it than that. And evidence is suggesting we are five to 10-year window away from this being available to you and me.
Adrian, you then turn to Constance. You quote Jeff Bezos, who argues that the real advantage lies in understanding that which will not change. Your slides also reference research from Landes, Robertson, Banerjee, and Duflo, and others on long-term prosperity drivers. So what are the durable principles that help investors navigate fracture, and how can they anchor decisions to unchanging fundamentals?
You know, I love Jeff Bezos's point, because it's so seductive to think about, you know, what's going to change. It's much more interesting to talk about the things that change than the things that are constant. But if we, Jeff Bezos urges us to, you know, pay attention also to the things that are constant, you know, the point that you're making. And there's at least two really big arguments to make here. The first is that always and everywhere, the driver, the ultimate driver of investment value is the ability of the asset to generate some return. We've got exceptions. You know, Bitcoin might be the exception, precious metals might be the exception. That was our last conversation, Ron. You know, but those are the exception. For the most part, the worth of an asset is driven by, and to be simplistic about it, its cash flow, its ability to generate yield, whether it's a government bond, real estate, or equities. And in the next breath, the most powerful driver of that return component, that intrinsic value, is the economic context and the industry within which that asset exists. So if you've got a fast-growing economy with a viable industry, you're going to find that all else equal, your asset is going to become worth more. This is a constant. And so it implores us to give attention then to, and back to the economic question, what then makes economies robust? What makes economies perform well? What allows Poland to become the superstar of Europe over the last 30 years? And can that superstardom continue? And then what do assets need to have as intrinsic attributes in order to be able to endure change and hang on to the engines that give it the horsepower to generate yield? And those attributes are enduring. We've spoken about both of them in the past. The first I capture in my six-factor model. The second I capture in the attributes of agility and absorption when it comes to the strategic positioning of businesses.
Your final caution deals with information quality. You show that AI now produces more online content than humans. So how should investors distinguish knowledge from noise when machine-generated content dominates the information environment?
Isn't this a cool point?
Very much so.
the chart that you're referring to from this presentation shows that recently content generated by machines has overtaken content generated by minds. And that, you know, if you just doom scrolling, then the majority, it's still, at the moment it's a slim majority, but the majority of what you are looking at is not the creation of human thought, human ingenuity, you know, at the first derivative. Of course, behind the machines are brilliant brains. But the stuff that we are consuming or being offered to consume, the majority of it is now generated by machines, not minds. And so here is a word of caution, you know, I guess, in closing out our conversation, is be very careful, you know, of what you take at face value as being fact. You know, it may well be machine generated. We know that machines have behaviors, they have biases, they have beliefs. They draw on old patterns to suggest new patterns. They don't have minds in which they can imagine a future. They are using what they know from the past. And so in the one breath, you know, while I've spoken to the magnificence of machines, we need to be very, very careful, you know, in thinking about the narrative that we draw from the content that machines generate. And this is a place to be mindful.
So that cliche that says don't believe everything you read has become more relevant than ever. Well, that's all the time we have for today. Adrian, thank you again for helping us unpack this fractured global landscape. Your insight adds real depth to our long game series and provide a valuable lens for long-term decision making. To all our CityWire South African listeners, thank you for listening to this episode of Money, Markets and Masterminds with me, editor Ruan Uester, and with my very, very competent and gorgeous producer, Vera Loba da Silva from the CityWire Studios team. Please subscribe, leave a review and share this episode if you enjoyed it. You can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts and Iono.fm and on the CityWire South Africa website, where our full library of multimedia content is available. And with that, and until next time, goodbye.